Okay, so at this point, we've accumulated enough knowledge to be able to do a somewhat hand-waving derivation of the spectrum of bosonic string theory. Somewhat hand-waving because we have not learned how to use ghosts in VRST quantization yet. So there are we cannot do things really properly. We can proceed in a way analogous to Gupta Bloor quantization in gauge theory. We impose some quantum version of the classical constraints, gauge fixing constraints, a bit by hand. Unfortunately, in order to do so, we'll have to know at least a couple of numbers which cannot be derived within this formalism. So we'll have to just assume them for now and compute them next week. So these two numbers are the Casimir energy of the vacuum which receives contribution from the whatever directions of space-time we have and from the metric degrees of freedom, from the gauge degrees of freedom. So if you remember, it was minus 1 over 24 for a single direction in space-time. Now, the other piece of information we need is the critical dimension. So how many of these scalar fields describing the motion of the string do we have? And our objective is to impose this constraint on the states of our on the Fock space of our theory of these 26 scalar fields. Now we cannot just require this to hold as a quantum mechanical statement, because as you remember, when we expanded out the stress tensor, it contains both creation and destruction modes. And there is no way for the creation modes to annihilate states. So the best we can do is to require that the destruction operators will annihilate physical states. And for positive n. And similarly, creation operators should annihilate the physical brass. Finally, we need to impose that the zero mode vanishes. And here is where this A plays a role. So if these conditions hold, then clearly when you sandwich the stress tensor between physical states, you get zero. Because the modes of stress tensor will annihilate either the left, right hand side or the left hand side. I also need to impose the same equations for L bars.
Why don't we want TAV equals zero? Why do we want TAV equals zero?
So remember, classically, we were trying to solve this nonlinear problem of the extremal surface of space-time. We reduced it to a set of linear equations together with this constraint. So we're trying to quantize the classical system. So to find a quantum version of imposing T equal to zero. So the constraint was T equal to zero.
Okay. Is that the
because
trace?
It was.
Was it trace?
No, so the trace of T is going to be zero just because the theory is one invariant. On the other hand, we gauge the way the metric, but we still need to impose the equations of motion for the metric. The equations of motion of the metric are variation of the action with respect to the metric, which is the stress tensor. So okay. Now, so states which satisfy these conditions are called primary states in conformal theory. You probably already encountered this notion. Now, this is not enough. So if we just throw away, if we just restrict ourselves to states of this form, we will not get a nice Hilbert space with a positive definite inner product. Simply because if I have a state of the form L minus N acting on something else, then this state will be orthogonal to physical states. So if I have a state which is both physical and null, it will have zero inner product with every other state in the Hilbert space. So the best we can do is to take the primary, the space of primary states, and quotient it by the intersection of the primary states and null states. Descendant. Sorry, this is something of the sum is called the descendant. So. So you take the primary states with L0 equal to A, and we quotient away by the descendants. So remember from conformal field theory, the space of states of the theory is organized in towers. Top of each tower there is a primary, and from the primary you can get a whole tower of descendants by acting with the modulus of the stress tensor. Sometimes it happens that inside these towers there are other primaries. So we need to eliminate that. Okay, now it's still not obvious that at the end of this we are going to get a nice Hilbert space with a positive definite inner product. Definitely not obvious at all. And indeed, if you do this exercise with random values of A and D, you will probably not find a nice Hilbert space with a positive definite inner product. It's a fun exercise to check that instead for these values, level by level, everything has positive norm. It's actually a pretty tricky theorem to prove. Called the no-ghost theorem. Now, I would like to remind you of something that happens in gauge theory. Right? In gauge theory, when you quantize the gauge boson, the commutational relations of the time-like component of the gauge field have the wrong sign, and so they give rise to states with negative norm. When you do this operation in gauge theory, miraculously you end up eliminating all of those states and not precisely those states. So somehow, and that works nicely in signature 1, comma D, right? That somehow the gauge freedom is just what you need to eliminate one time-like direction. So we will have a similar difficulty here or a similar feature here. Because when we define the commutation relations of the modes, which now remember our scalar fields have Lorentz indices because they describe their position in space-time. So when you expand them out, you will have oscillators which also carry these Lorentz indices. When you write the commutation relations, you got to put a Lorentz metric there. So as a result, one of the oscillators, the one that corresponds to the propagation in time, has wrong sign. So the Hilbert space of the not standard scalar field we studied yesterday had definitely inner product, positive inner product. But for one of the scalar fields, the kinetic term has the wrong sign. And so all the inner products become negative definite. Okay, so our final theory will make sense if this procedure erases all of those null states. Okay, so let's proceed level by level. So our generic state is labeled by some momentum for the zero modes, together with a whole bunch of oscillators. Acting on it. The L0 eigenvalue of the state is P square over 2 plus whatever we have added of holomorphic oscillators. And L0 bar is P square over 2 plus whatever we have added of anti-holomorphic oscillators. So both these have to be equal to 1. In particular, the sum of the total holomorphic level has to be equal to the total anti-holomorphic level. And then we need to check, using our expression for the L's, what was it? I don't remember. I didn't print it. There might have been a minus sign, I forget. Doesn't really matter. Do you remember if there was a minus sign here? Do you have a copy of the notes from yesterday? Doesn't matter. I just didn't want to write wrong formula. Anyway, using this definition of the L's, we can now check which of these states are primaries and which one are null. So let's start from the beginning. When is this a primary? So is this a primary? Notice that if M is positive, you always have a positive mode acting first in this normal order, followed potentially by a negative mode. So is this Q by positive L, by L's with positive indices? Yeah, because it's Q by all A's with positive indices. So when I act with an L of positive index, the A kills, the positive A in there kills it. So this is a primary. Uh, What about L0? Eigenvalue. What? So, for which p is this equal to zero?
Root two.
Well, this is really a vector. So p squared equal to 2. So this physical state has a negative mass, has a negative mass squared. So it's a Taquion. Mass squared minus 2. In the unit set by setting the tension of the string equal to 1. So at low energy, it's a very massive tachyon, very unstable tachyon. Okay. So this is bad, but we already announced that bosonic string was going to be unstable. Can this ever be null? Can this ever be a descendant of something else by a positive L? By a negative L, sorry. No, because negative L's always add some negative A's. So a negative L acting on a state always increases the total level. So the sum of n's here is called the level. L's with negative n, or any operator with negative index acting on a state, makes the level go down. So these are nice and physical and not null. So at low energy, the R string spectrum will include this tachyonic particle. Next, let's now go down to total level 1 and 1. So we are looking at states of this form. Let me put some kind of a polarization. So, is this a primary? What do I need to check? Well, it's surely going to be killed by L2, L3, L4, L5, because those would try to, they would put the total level to positive, and then some of the A's, positive A's, would kill P. So, the only thing we need to check is, does L1 annihilate this? So we saw the commutation relations between L's and A's last time. When I commute L1 across A minus 1, I produce an A0. So D is equal to 0 implies that an A0 is the same as P. So implies that epsilon mu nu P mu should be 0. Same calculation done with L1 bar tells me that epsilon mu nu P nu is 0. So I will need these conditions to be true in order to get a physical state. Then I need to check this condition. This contributes 1. And so I learned that P squared must be 0. So this part of the Hilbert space of the scalar fields will give us massless string states. String states that look like massless particles with a couple of Lorentz indices. And with the constraint that they should be transverse. This is familiar for massless particles. And then finally, I need to check under which conditions this could be L minus 1 of something. So what happens if I do L minus 1 of some lambda mu A bar minus 1 mu p? L minus 1 has inside an A minus 1 A 0. So this produces a state of the form p nu lambda p nu lambda mu a mu minus 1 a bar mu minus 1 p. So states of this form must be null, must be thrown away. So we don't just impose this constraint on epsilon, we also require that we also identify states which differ by this transformation. Again, this looks familiar. I mean, if I just had only one index, right, then transversality, this would be transversality for something like a gauge field. And this would have been gauge symmetry for the polarization of a, sorry, for the polarization of a gauge field. So the polarization of the gauge field, right, is transverse to the momentum, and it's and is invariant under shifting the polarization vector by the momentum. That's sort of the Fourier transform of gauge symmetry in space-time. So if we Fourier transform, right, here, this was describing a field which satisfies some equation like Laplacian equal to minus 2 pi. Well, I get this sign wrong always. Doesn't matter. Here, I have some field which satisfies some divergence equal to 0, some transversality, and has sort of a gauge symmetry in space-time. Except that the gauge symmetry parameters are vectors instead of being scalars. So in order to disentangle a bit what's happening, it's useful to sort of split these into symmetric and anti-symmetric parts. And then we could also subtract off a sort of a traceless, something like a trace part. If you do that, you will see that the theory has sort of three massless fields. One of them is a field which has symmetric Lorentz indices. One is a field which has anti-symmetric Lorentz indices. And the other, and the final one, is just a scalar field. And these are massless fields, and they have a gauge symmetry. So the polarization for this one changes by something like this. And you should recognize the gauge transformations of the of a graviton. This one is a little bit less familiar. We'll discuss it later. And this is a massless scalar field. Now, so this looks like there is some state of the string that looks like a graviton, but is it a graviton or not? What does that actually mean? To call it a graviton, you probably want to see that scattering amplitude of this mode are reproduced by the Einstein Lagrangian, for example. You might also want to check that the interaction with all other matter fields reproduces the usual coupling of fields to the metric, linearized. Now, all of these statements are actually automatic as long as the scattering matrix is unitary and well behaved. So there are some very nice theorems in quantum field theory, which tells you how massless particles with spin can couple to other particles. These theorems are derived by looking at scattering amplitudes where a light particle is emitted in the limit where the momentum of that particle goes to zero. And these sort of theorems tell you things like, if you have a massless graviton in your theory, it will couple to other fields in a unique way. It will couple to the stress tensor of those fields. And it will self-interact in a unique way, which is the Einstein linearized interaction in the Einstein Lagrangian. It's at three levels. So in a sense, as long as the scattering amplitudes computed out of this bosonic string make sense perturbatively, these will behave like a graviton automatically. But of course, one can check in practice, and we'll actually do so. We will look at interactions between, say, a tachyon and a graviton and check that the interaction vertex is the correct form. So this explains one piece of the massless spectrum. Any questions? Okay. Now, in order to understand this kind of field, we should talk about generalized gauge fields. So in four dimensions, we are used to gauge fields, which are described by one forms, which have a single Lorentz index. It turns out that if you have a dimension higher than four, there is a whole tower of fields which have properties analogous to standard gauge fields. The main difference is that while gauge fields couple to particles, these generalized gauge fields couple naturally to higher dimensional objects. So if you remember how a standard gauge field couples to a particle, right, it couples by some term in the Lagrangian like this. You take the integral on the word line. Of the pullback of your form. On the word line. This is a very nice coupling. It's a nice feature that does not even involve the metric. Forms can be integrated on lines without requiring a metric. Now, you can imagine easily generalizations of this. For example, you could have some field with two indices, which couples like this to a worksheet, to a string. So under which conditions this coupling is good parametrization invariant, independent of specific of the metric and so on. So under which condition does this coupling have the same good peak properties as this does? Well, if this is an anti-symmetric tensor, then this combination will transform by the Jacobian, by the determinant of the Jacobian under coordinate redefinitions on the worksheet. And so it will cancel the transformation of the net of the measure. Now here there are transformations of A which don't change the action, right? Which are gauge transformations. If you shift A by total derivative, this can be integrated. And what you're left with is just some contributions on the endpoint of the word line. And if your word line extends infinitely far or it's closed, this gauge invariant. In the same way, this action is invariant under gauge transformation, so this form. If you do a transformation like this, you can apply Stokes' theorem. And you see that this changes only by an integral of lambda on the boundary of the worksheet. Again, if the boundary goes to infinity or the worksheet is closed, this is gauge invariant. If you know differential forms, you recognize this as a true form. And this is a shifting the true form by an exact one form. By an exact true form. So these are generalized gauge fields. And you can get them for every value of the form degree. So you have an A, you can define an A3 of mu nu sigma, which would be totally antisymmetric and transformed by a true form, and so on and so forth. So it's kind of natural that the theory of strings would include a gauge field of this type, of this form, coupled to the string worksheet. And indeed, this is the case. So this is a true form gauge field. Right? It transforms with a minus instead of a plus. And you can check by studying scattering amplitudes of this field with the string worksheet, with other string states, that it couples at the leading order to the string worksheet precisely in this manner. So this gives a physical interpretation of this massless field. And you start noticing that essentially everything that the string can couple to, every background the string can naturally couple to, is emerging as a massless mode. So a string can naturally couple to a metric, just by propagating in a curved spacetime. And it can naturally couple to true form gauge field by coupling of this form.
Mm-hmm. Are transformation of your true form gauge field and your metric tied together? Do they have to be the same parameter?
No, see, if I take lambda equal to lambda tilde, this is only transforming the metric. If I take lambda equal to minus lambda tilde, this is only transforming B.
And when lambda is equal to lambda tilde, is that tied to diffeomorphisms, like the parameterizations of the capital X?
Right. For consistency, that will have to be the case, yes.
Okay. But not for the antisymmetric one?
No, that's right. The antisymmetric one will be just a gauge transformation for this B field. And then finally, there is this massless scalar field called the dilaton. And it's a bit trickier to show it, but the role it plays is that it changes the coupling of the strings. So local fluctuations in the value of this field change the strength of the interaction between strings. So the string changes the string coupling constant we I was schematically introducing at the beginning of the lectures. So these are the massless modes. And so these are the most important. Of course, we can continue the calculation to try to see what are the massive modes that occur at higher and higher levels. I'm not sure there is a good systematic way to do it. But I can at least sketch how one would proceed to do the calculation. So if we go at the next level, there are already quite a number of states, right? I can put minus ones. I can use some a minus twos. So all of these states, we will have b squared equal to minus 2. So will be states with a standard positive mass of order of the string scale. And now we need to check which of these states are annihilated by L1 and by L2. And it's a somewhat tedious calculation. And it ties them all together. So you get some linear constraints on the polarization vectors. Which will remove various components. See, each of these polarization vectors could be decomposed further, right? I could start taking traces, anti-symmetrize things, and I'll get a whole tower of Lorentz representations. Okay. Then, requiring that they are cubed by L1 and L2 will remove some of these. And then I'll remove further some by looking at what can be in the image of L1, of L minus 1 or L minus 2. If you do the calculation in detail, you will see that somehow numbers like p equal to 26 and a equal to 1 are a little bit special in terms of what cancels out, what drops out. At the end of the day, you get a positive definite spectrum, including some particles of various spin, massive particles of various spin. Notice that right, in four dimensions, when you look at massless particles, there are very strong constraints on which spin you can have. So if you have spin 1, you're a gauge field. If you have spin 2, you're a graviton. And if you have spin higher than 2, you are free, and you should be ignored. So just you don't get it in interacting theories. For massive particles, there are much fewer constraints, and that's okay. I mean, if you just look at the spectrum of nucleons, you'll find all sort of spins there, fadrons. If you look in higher dimension, similar theorems apply. Although the notion what counts as spin one or spin two is a little bit richer. So form fields like this all count as spin one. They're fine. They can interact with other things. Graviton has to behave as a graviton. It's the only spin two. And then everything else has to be massive. And this is indeed what the string spectrum is producing. I mean, I'm just saying over and over again the statement in different guises that the string perturbative string theory is unitary, gives rise to a unitary and well-defined scattering matrix. But you know, you see various manifestations of this in various corners. If you keep going, you will find more and more and more particles, you know, very large towers of particles, which have masses which are multiple, mass squares that are multiples of some basic amount. So you get sort of, you know, if you sort of draw pictures, so right, as you go up in level, you get higher and higher spin and higher mass. So if you sort of draw pictures on a spin and mass plane, you find these straight trajectories, which are sort of associated with the strings. Okay. Now, perhaps it would be instructive to show how some of these calculations can be done a bit more in detail. So suppose, for example, that you want to figure out what L1 of A minus 1 mu, A minus 1 nu, P is. Right? How do you do this calculation? Well, you recursively, you write first that this is equal to the commutator plus the expression with permuted order. Then you use the algebra for this commutator, and this gives you a zero mu, a minus 1 nu, p. And you trade this for a p. So I'm not keeping track of factors of I, minuses, pluses, whatever. And here, again, you do the commutator. After this gets here, it kills p. So you get another term, which is something like a minus 1 mu, p nu. So ultimately, you're going to get, from this, you're going to get some transversality constraint here. Yeah. If I want to compute L2 of A minus 1 mu, A minus 1 nu, acting on P, well, I do the same, except that this will produce an A1 mu, A minus 1 nu p when I do the commutator. And then an A minus 1 mu A1 nu p. This drops out. This gives me one further commutator. So when I apply it here, this is going to give me some tracelessness constraint. And so on and so forth. Okay. Now, when you try to figure out when some null states are also physical, when some descendants are also primaries, right, you end up doing calculations where you try to, you know, compute ln of L minus m acting on something. all of these calculations involve just the Virasoro algebra. And in particular, they involve D, which appears as the central charge in the Virasoro algebra. So that's why I was saying that the precise pattern of cancellations is sensitive to D and to A. It's because depending on D and on A, some of these expressions might vanish only for specific values of DNA. Okay. Now, we still have 15 minutes left, so I would like to make sure that all the questions that you have about this last week have been asked. So please ask questions. And try to clarify all possible confusions. Because next week we're going to start describing the BRST quantization. This will take several lectures. Was everything clear? Discuss them. So a couple lectures ago, I decided not to describe for you the modelized spaces of complex structures, which, I mean, perhaps I can say a couple words at least about that, about how string theory calculations can match, at least intuitively, quantum theory calculations at low energy or large distances. And sort of why string theory calculations can be better behaved quantum theory calculations. Suppose that you're looking at a scalar field theory, and you're trying to compute at tree level a scattering amplitude of two particles going into two particles. So typically, you will have to sum over tree diagrams. TNU channel diagrams. So each of these in the proper time formalism required to do some integral over a proper time, the length of some segment. And this integral will have a special behave point where the length goes to zero. So the modelized space you're integrating over looks like three half lines. Okay. Now, how would the same calculation look like in string theory? Well, we need to understand which sort of complex structures can we put on string diagrams, which have four external legs. Now, it's not intuitive at all to figure out what are the possible complex structures on a picture like this. But let me just give you a statement, and then we can try to prove it. I want to say that there are regions in the space of complex structures where the string worksheet really looks like one of these pictures, in the sense that it has long thin tubes. Which mimic the topology of the quantum field theory diagram. And roughly, the complex structure is parametrized by two pieces of data. How long is this tube? And how twisted? The sort of true gauge invariant notions. So that means that there are two coordinates on the model space in this region. One looks a lot like LS, and the other looks a lot like it's a circle. So there is some region of the model space of complex structure which looks like a cylinder. Now, as the length becomes shorter and shorter, the notion of length becomes less well defined, because this looks less and less like one of those diagrams. So as LS approaches zero, something will happen to the moduli space. Okay. Then I can look at diagrams that looks like this. So when I draw a picture like this, what do I mean? I mean, look at this, put the metric that is obvious in the picture, and then use that metric to define up to wild transformations to define a complex structure. Okay. So this will give me another region of moduli space, which looks like this. And then washes that look like this will give me a third region of the moduli space. Now, it turns out that the actual moduli space, and I'm sorry that, unfortunately, because the moduli space is two-dimensional and watch is two-dimensional, I'm sure that there can be some confusion about different pictures. I should probably use different colors. But here I was defining, I was drawing watch sheets. And here I was drawing moduli spaces. So it just so happened that the moduli space of complex structures for this worksheet looks like this. So there are three regions, one of which, each of which looks roughly like the quantum field theory integration contour. But they join smoothly. There is a smooth moduli space which has regions which look like the quantum field theory moduli space.
So would this be like the moduli space for two strings, two cross strings scattering into two cross strings at tree level?
Yes, that's correct. And so, in particular, these regions that look like quantum field theory are regions where the string is intuitively long and thin. So where the string looks like a particle. And you can really check that when you study scattering amplitudes, the integral is sort of dominated by the integral for processes which involve low energies and long distances is dominated by the region of the integration that corresponds to something of this form. Now, intuitively, the equation of motion for the metric tells you that the metric tries to be the induced metric. So if you have a process where the strings in physical space are very long and thin, in the moduli space, they'll be dominated by something like this. So this idea is generalizes. So when you look at, you know, loop processor loops to any number of external legs, the model space of complex structures will be a very complicated manifold, but it will have nice patches. Each patch will look like sort of a complexification of the modelized space of Feynman diagrams with that topology. But then these patches are glued together in a complicated way. There is something called string field theory, which is a sort of a systematic way to cut up this space into pieces which are really labeled by Feynman diagrams, and which allows you to write down string theory as a quantum field theory with infinitely many fields. It's an interesting subject. It's not developed to a point where it could give us any non-perturbative information about the closed string theory, but it's actually quite useful in doing concrete calculations, because you know string theory is going to have all the subtleties which occur in quantum field theory scattering algebras. So it does not have UV divergences, pretty much because the dangerous regions of the modelized spaces of quantum field theory are smoothened out. But it has infrared divergences. It has renormalization of the mass. It has all sort of low energy, interesting phenomena. And those phenomena are best understood in quantum field theory. So when you try to deal with them in string theory, these sort of ways to make string theory look like a quantum field theory are very useful. That's why so closed string field theory is still a subject of investigation now. Okay, so at some point in the lectures, we will do this calculation. We will compute a scattering amplitude of two strings off two strings by integrating over this modular space. And so looking at the details of that calculation, you can see, you'll be able to see all these unwavy statements that I'm making now.
In pain. In the full pain.
It's not that painful. Not that painful, actually.
Are there methods to calculate the scattering amplitudes without actually integrating the modelized spaces?
So it's kind of amusing that because, so in quantum field theory, using Feynman diagrams is definitely not a good way to do calculations. There are better ways. Funny enough, some of those better ways were discovered by looking at how the calculations are done here, because it turns out that these ones are easier. There are a lot of relations that were discovered this way. Then presumably then there are even more refined methods which presumably can also be applied to string theory scattering amplitudes, sort of twistorial methods. Although some of them are very specific to four dimensions, and so they don't immediately generalize. For example, there are some statements called KLT relations which sort of express gravity scattering amplitudes into bilinear expressions in gauge field scattering amplitudes. And ultimately, they're motivated by the fact that in the string theory calculation, there is an holomorphic and anti-holomorphic part of the calculation, which for most of the calculation go in parallel and they're joined together only at the end. And the holomorphic part of the calculation look like a calculation for a gauge field. So these kind of calculations are not that bad. Indeed, if it wasn't that the bosonic string has both graviton and B field and dilaton, it would be a great way to compute gravity scattering amplitudes. Unfortunately, it does a calculation where graviton, B field, and dilaton are all present. And so if you wanted to only know scattering amplitudes with intermediate graviton states, you need to work harder.
Mm-hmm. Are these moduli spaces always two-dimensional manifolds, or?
No, they are, the dimensions is, well, the complex dimension is the same as the real dimension of the corresponding space of Feynman diagrams. So here there was one internal edge, so you get a one complex dimensional space. In general, the complex dimension will be the number of internal edges of the Feynman diagram, of the corresponding Feynman diagram. So